Sometimes I just wanna run away with you to someplace new, someplace new. Sweet Erin, won't you come with me to the Hollow Earth? We'll speak our vows in a cigarette.
Negative emotion or mental poison has an inherent purity that we don't recognize because we are so accustomed to its appearance as emotion. The true nature of the five poisons, ignorance, attachment, aversion, jealousy, and pride, is the five wisdoms. Just as poison can be taken medicinally to effect a cure, each poison of the mind, worked with properly, can be resolved into its wisdom nature and thus enhance our spiritual practice. If while in the throes of desire, you simply relax, without moving your attention, that space of the mind is called discriminating wisdom. You don't abandon desire, instead you reveal its wisdom nature.
Ah, so cute. All right, you two, go play. It's almost time for a nap. You got 10 minutes, you can go play in the yard. Okay, kiddo, I love the flute, but it's time to go play now. Go play.
Thank you, Papa.
You're welcome, Shakti. Okay, Padma, now it's time to go play. Go play, yeah. I'll see you in a little bit. Aren't kids cute? The youngest has, I don't know, found some bamboo in the backyard or something and fashioned that flute you heard him playing. And the oldest has been saying these, whatever that is, I guess little stories that he's been hearing in his dreams, or at least that's what he says. What can you do, kids? Am I right, people? I just want to watch football and relax, have a nice cold beer and watch football. But these kids, they start playing the flute, they start saying that spiritual stuff, and I'm like, it's football. And then I start weeping from the beauty of what they teach me. I'm sorry for my voice right now. The whole family came down with something called RSV. It's a really fun one. When you put your kids in preschool, you might as well just sign up for Disease of the Month Club from Wuhan, because that's what it's like. They just bring home little biological gifts for you. And this one sucks. RSV is interesting. Kind of like a really rotten cold. To me, it felt worse than COVID. It was just, it's like really gross. You get real congested, real filled up with snot. And it's got psychological components. You start hearing Halloween decorations talking to you, which is a weird symptom. But if that is happening to you, especially if your Halloween decorations are telling you like the secrets of the Kennedy assassination, then you should get checked out. You probably have RSV. I thought the pumpkin in our kitchen that talks when you walk in front of it, I thought that was just some Halloween shit when it was telling me that Kennedy getting assassinated was some kind of Masonic conspiracy. But as it turns out, it was just a regular pumpkin, not an electronic one at all. And that's when I realized, oh shit, I've got RSV. So I'm getting better now, but definitely if you're experiencing talking, Halloween decorations, clusters of vibrating mice that glow, It's a very beautiful, enticing glow. RSV. I mean, all this is on the CDC's website. Champions of yore, if any champion of yore comes to your house or like runs up to you on your walks to offer you wreaths, it's RSV. Very strange disease. Definitely get checked out right away if you're exhibiting any of these symptoms. And we all know what the cure is. Nobody likes it. Maybe some people do. I don't know. It just depends on what mood I'm in. But yeah, you just need to find the friendliest person in your neighborhood and eat their cum, and it goes away. Mine is almost gone. We have got an excellent podcast for you today. John Lockley is here with us today. We're going to jump right into it. But first, this. This episode of the DTFH has been supported by Athletic Greens. And if only I had not run out of my sweet, sweet greens, maybe I wouldn't be experiencing RSV. I started taking Athletic Greens because I don't have time to keep up with the vitamin thing. I don't have time to do that. I'm forgetful. I get confused easily. I don't know how many vitamins I'm taking. I don't want to walk around with bags of vitamins or have this weird vitamin daily vitamin calendars that people have these days. I need something simple. And that's why I use Athletic Greens. It's easy. There's no vitamin math. There's no vitamin calculus. You just take one delicious scoop. You put it in some water. You mix it up, and you're absorbing 75 high-quality vitamins, minerals, whole food source superfoods, probiotics, and adaptogens to help you start your day right. This special blend of ingredients supports your gut health, your nervous system, your immune system, your energy recovery, focus, and aging, all the things. If anyone from Athletic Greens is listening to this, can you please send me a wonderful new supply of greens? I don't know how much longer I can go on without it. Instant karma in the form of RSV. It tastes good. It's easy. It's lifestyle friendly. And the sweeties over at Athletic Greens will actually send you a year's supply of vitamin D. A year's supply. That's a year for you. If you, like me, have a bunker with specially trained, highly powerful, deadly military officers waiting for the collapse of society, it will feed them for about a month because trained military folks, they take a lot of vitamin D. The point is, if it's just for you, it's a year. It is time for you to reclaim your health with Athletic Greens. Right now is the time to do it. Right now, it's time to reclaim your health and arm your immune system with convenient daily nutrition. Don't let this happen to you. We are heading into a rough flu and cold season, folks. Just one scoop and a cup of water every day. That's it. No need for a million different pills and supplements to look out for your health. To make it easy, Athletic Greens is going to give you a free one-year supply of immune-supporting vitamin D and five free travel packs with your first purchase. All you have to do is visit athleticgreens.com/Duncan. Again, it's athleticgreens.com/Duncan to take ownership over your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance. Athletic Greens. Send me more, please. Thank you, Athletic Greens. With us here today is a fascinating human, John Lockley. He's born in apartheid South Africa, and at 18, he started having these dreams, which were calling him to train as a sengoma, which is essentially a kind of shaman / healer / teacher. If you enjoy this conversation, you can find John by going to johnlockley.com. And now, everybody, welcome to the DTFH, John Lockley.
Welcome, welcome on in.
John, welcome to the DTFH. I'm excited to talk to you. I got a lot of questions for you.
Thanks, Duncan. I'm really happy to be here. I'm excited. You,
first of all, I already said this in the intro, but you are a shaman. And if you'll forgive me, in your book, the pronunciations were impossible. So can you help me pronounce Igira Elekula? Is that the right? How do you say that?
Well, I'm a traditional healer in South Africa known as a Sangoma, and I'm a Sangoma in the Xhosa tradition. And in the Xhosa tradition, Sangomas are called Igqirhas. So I'm part of a tribe or community of Amagqirha.
See, I knew I wasn't pronouncing it right. And if someone had come and said, listen, there's going to be world peace. We're going to end the conflict in Ukraine if you can pronounce this correctly. I never would have, because that click, I never would have gotten the click. Would you mind saying it again? It's really beautiful.
Igqirha. I'm known as an Igqirha, which is an old Bushman or Khoisan word, and it means the one who holds the lightning rod of the ancestors. So for Western listeners, for people in California and other places, it's like being a Kundalini yogi. Kundalini yogi working with the energy of the spine and of the universe.
Now, before everyone, and forgive me, these are the times we're living in right now, and I just to sort of stop the comments of people saying, oh great, a white dude who is saying he's a healer in this tradition. Do you think you could tell people a little bit about how you learned to do this and who you've worked with, just so people know it's not like you just titled yourself this. You're someone who has spent significant amounts of time training in this tradition. And I just know, I'm so sorry, but I just know people are going to be like, come on, cultural appropriation. You can't go and become this or that if you're Caucasian. No offense, folks out there, but this is not just somebody who invented this for themselves.
Okay, so the first thing I need to say is that I never chose to become a Sangoma. And a Sangoma, for the listeners, is a traditional African shaman. I never chose it. I never went looking for it. It came looking for me. And my story is a long story, which is why I wrote a book called Leopard Warrior. So all those folks who want to understand more, you can just get Leopard Warrior, and it's available anywhere online. So basically with me, my elders, my Xhosa elders, invited me to become their apprentice. And it was just after the civil war in South Africa, which was well known in terms of apartheid. Apartheid is an Afrikaans word, and it means separation. It was a horrendous civil war that went on for many years. And when I finally met my teacher, I was very sick with what we call the calling illness, which is called the Twaza illness. And it's endemic all over Southern Africa with people who have the calling to become a medicine person or a Sangoma. So you never choose to become a Sangoma. This is a very, very critical point. You never ever choose to become that. It's something that is offered to you. So first you go for a divination or consultation with a teacher, with a Sangoma in a lineage, and then they will confirm that you have the illness, the Twaza illness, and then they will also offer to train you. And this is what happened with me. So my first consultation with my teacher in the late 90s, just after Nelson Mandela was released, I had this vision and had this feeling about having a traditional Sangoma consultation, which is kind of unheard of for a white person. But at that stage, the barriers between the races had opened and South Africa was a democratic country. Yes. And I'd been suffering from the Twaza illness for over 10 years. And for those people who don't know, it's a physical illness. It's not just psychological, but it has very strong psychological and spiritual aspects to it. So physically, I was very weak and my immune system was shot, which meant that I was constantly getting sick. And I'd been to all the specialist doctors in Johannesburg, and they found nothing wrong with me. But I kept getting one illness after the next, and it was quite scary, to be honest with you. I had over seven different kinds of mainstream illnesses. So The second thing of the 12's illness over and above the physical is this psychic ability. So I'd have dreams, I would see the future, I'd see what was happening to people I didn't know, and these things would come to pass time and time and time again.
Can I pause you there? Can you describe, walk me through a typical dream like this? When you're seeing these people, how vivid is it? Just if you could just maybe be a little more detailed in your description of this sort of dream.
Okay, well, the dreams would come in different forms. But one dream I remember, I was at university at the time, and I kind of woke up from my sleep, and there was one of the mothers of one of the students in the residence I was staying at came to me in my dreams, and she said to me, "Please, you need to speak to my son at breakfast time and tell him that I need to speak to him urgently about such and such." And this guy wasn't even a friend of mine. I saw him, I used to greet him, I knew his name, but I didn't really know him. And then when I sat down, it wasn't actually breakfast because I was a bit nervous at that stage. I waited till supper time. And then I was sitting next to him, and he was quite an open-minded kind of guy. And I just said to him, "I want to share something with you. And you might think it's weird, but I was going to say it." And then I shared this with him about his mother. And I just said, "Look, I have no understanding what this is all about, but my sense is that you need to, you need to move on this." And he thanked me. He thanked me. He said, "Thank you so much."
What was going on? Did you ever find out?
No, he's a very private person, and I'm also a private person, so we weren't friends, so I didn't want to, push too much. But another dream I had was also a person who was a friend of mine. He was breaking up with his girlfriend, and I didn't know anything about that. And in the dream, I saw the breakup, I saw them moving in separate ways. And in the dream, I thought this was really mysterious because they looked like they're really close. When I saw him and his girlfriend walking, he'd always say hi, and they were like the lovers of campus,
Yeah.
And then it must have been a week or so later, I saw him, he looked a bit dejected, and I said, what's up? And he said, he had broken up with his girlfriend, and I'd already seen it. I'd already seen all the aspects to it in the dream. But the hard thing for me actually, and it still is when I dream about death, and I dream about people who are going to die, or sometimes I'm shown how I can stop the person dying. So let's say someone is very sick, and I'll have a dream, and I'm shown the illness, and then I'm shown that I need to basically be like a 911 paramedic and get that person to medical intervention as soon as possible. And I have done that, and I've been able to help people who are probably close to death. But other times, which is very difficult for me, is when I'm just shown that someone is going to die, but I'm not shown how, and there's nothing I can do about it. And that for me is very, very difficult,
Wow. Well, I'll tell you who it's more difficult for, the people you tell. Yeah. That's got to feel rotten when you're like, "Hey, you're going to die. I don't know how to stop it."
I had this experience with one of my Sangoma elders, actually, her son, who was basically like a young Rinpoche in the Tibetan system. I mean, he's extremely gifted. And when he drummed at the age of 6 years old, you'd feel vibrations in the wall, and people would instantly get a Sangoma calling, and they would kind of go into the state of, call it the paranormal. It was incredible. And I became very, very close to her son. And one day I had this dream where I was shown that he died. I actually was shown very clearly that he had died, and I was shown his funeral. And I woke up from the dream shaking, and this young friend of mine, another Sangoma, came to visit me for breakfast, and I shared the dream with him, and I said, "Gogo mhlobo, andiyazi iphupho yam, andiyazi." I said, "I don't know this dream, and I wasn't shown how he was going to die, so I can't tell his mother, I can't tell the teacher."
Yeah.
And he said, "Yes, because you don't know." And then a year went by, and I came home from being overseas, actually from being with you at one of the Ram Dass retreats, and the whole room was quiet in my teacher's house. And I said, "What's happened?" And they said, "No, Asisake, yeah, or Yiva." They said his name, they said that he had just died. And Asasaki or Yafa, which means the person's died, or Swelekile. So it was very, very sad. And then when I went to the funeral, I helped bury him, the young guy, and went to his mother and I told her about the dream. And I said, "I'm sorry, Mama, I never shared the dream, but I wasn't shown anything in terms of how he was going to die, because he died from a drowning." And my teacher said to me, "No, you did the right thing. Thank you." She says, right. "I can feel your love for my son. It's okay, Klingo. It's okay, John. Don't worry."
Right, because if you tell someone that, all it's going to do is make them paranoid.
Exactly.
The period leading up to it.
Yeah.
This is.
Do you mind if I just finish the story?
Ahead. I would love to
just
hear that.
Just give me a couple minutes.
I'm excited to get into this question, I'm very excited to hear your story.
I just want to pause this a bit because, you know, cultural appropriation is a very, very serious topic, and I can understand all the aspects of why it is serious. So let me just speak a little bit about my background, just so people are not judging me by the color of my skin, okay? So I had this calling, and I still have this calling very strongly. I was very sick for 10 years. Nelson Mandela was released. And then I had this feeling and intuition, because of my dreams calling me in such a vivid way, I need to have a divination with a bona fide Xhosa Sangoma traditional healer, shaman. I need to do this. So I contacted, I was actually a psychology student at the time, so I contacted one of the members of staff in our psychology department, who was a Xhosa man, and he was a translator, and someone I got on with very well.
Will you forgive me, a what man?
He was a Xhosa man. So he was in the Xhosa tribe. So like Mandela is a Xhosa man.
Okay. Got it. Okay, cool.
So I contacted my friend Sid and I said, "Please, can you organize a consultation with me with a traditional healer, with the Sangoma?" And this was like, you know, in the late 90s. And he said, "Sure." He said, "I've been visiting this particular Sangoma," and he mentioned her name. And he said, "My son has been very sick and she's been able to help him." So I was like, "Great." I said, "When can we go?" He said, "I'll make an appointment. Let's go tomorrow." So then the next day we went. And when I arrived, I just saw my teacher on the other side of the fence, and she was sweeping, and she had this very stern look on her face. She had a lot of energy around her, and she just looked at us, nodded. And then my friend greeted her in the traditional way, and she just pointed, "Jikalele," which means turn, go to the back. For Vumisa. Vumisa means divination. So we went to the back and we put the exchange down, which was money, put that down. And then she went into trance very, very quickly. She called in her ancestors and she went into the very, very deep trance. And then she came out of the trance and she said, "Weneliklicha, you are a senior Sangoma. Ikazini ab mshlope, your blood is white blood like mine." She says, "You have the calling like I do." And she said, "I dreamt about you last night."
Wow.
And she said, "In the dream last night, the great spirit Utiko said that I must prepare myself for someone from another culture to come to me, and that I was going to train this person from another culture to become a senior Sangoma like myself. And then Utiko, the great spirit, said, I need to prepare myself for this moment." So she looked at me and she said, "You are the one." And she said, "You've had the calling for many years." She said, "You almost died." And she said, "What took you so long to come to me?"
Wow.
And I said to her, "Apartheid, Mama, apartheid." And she said, "Utiqo nkosiyam, abe tu ndiqolo." She said, oh God, I'm so sorry. We almost lost you." And in that moment, a tear went rolling down her face, and a tear went rolling down my face. And in that moment, there was no black and white. There was just two people who fell in love with each other. And that's what's happened. So
beautiful.
We've been close for over 20 years now.
How many? Like
over 20 years, yes. And then after that moment, she invited me to be her student, to be her apprentice. So for all the listeners, that's the clincher here. So cultural appropriation does not work in my situation because I never went looking for it. it was something that was offered to me, even though I didn't want to in the beginning. So I said to her, what does it mean to become a Sangoma? Because I was aware that I was walking into hellfire, being a white guy and being her apprentice. And she said, to become a Sangoma means that you're going to be able to heal people in different ways. And once you accept that, the ancestors will work through you. You're going to stop being so sick, and you're going to be able to heal people in many ways. And she said, if you agree, we are Vuma, do you agree? And I said, well, that sounds like a good thing, heal people and stop being sick. So I said, okay, India Vuma, I agree. So she said, okay, we'll come back tomorrow and I'll give you your first white beads, which is a sign that you'll be my apprentice. And then afterwards, she introduced me to a husband who's a tribal elder. And he looked at me with these clear eyes. We say the eyes of Nkwenkwezi, the eyes of the star people. And he said to me, this home is now your home. Anytime you want to come here, the door's open. And he said, do you accept to become an apprentice in this house? And I said, yes, Ndiyavuma. He said, you are more than welcome. You are part of this family. And that's it. So I was invited by these powerful elders who didn't just invite me once. I was invited again and again by different elders to become a Sangoma.
A quick break to thank Squarespace for supporting this episode of the DTFH. Squarespace will help you blast your podcast onto the internet as though it were some trans-dimensional hypercube of glory. What that means is they've got everything you need to create beautiful websites. They've got shopping cart functionality. They even have paywalls if you want to create special content for your fans. It's perfect for anyone who's thinking about starting a podcast. They've done it. It's everything you need. And the proof is in the pudding. Go to DuncanTrussell.com. That's a Squarespace website. I've been using them for years and I love them. Head over to Squarespace.com/Duncan and try them out. And when you're ready to launch, all you have to do is use offer code Duncan and you'll get 10% off your first order of a website or a domain. You could try it out for free. If they've got what you need, which for sure they will have, then all you have to do is use offer code Duncan. You'll get 10% off your first order of a website or a domain. Now, back to the show. How did your friends in college react to what you were doing? How did, you know, you're studying psychology, which, I mean, Western psychology, I guess you have some Jungian stuff with dreams, but certainly not like precognition and all that stuff is generally like shot down or just sort of overlooked, if anything. How did your professors or like colleagues or fellow students react to what you were doing?
Well, I didn't really share it with too many people, to be honest. I shared it with my girlfriend at the time, and I was extremely, like, almost paranoid about keeping everything really quiet and very private. I also shared it with one of my psychology professors because I was close to him, and he just didn't comment. He didn't say anything. And so there was this air of silence around me, and there was no words spoken. So I, even within my own family and extended family, I learned to keep quiet about this calling, because it was misunderstood and there was a lot of fear around it. There was a lot of criticism.
Yeah.
And I learned very early on to basically keep my mouth shut, you know.
Did you stay in college?
I did, yeah. The first time the calling came really strongly, I had to drop out. So because the visions and everything was so strong. So then I dropped out of university and I went to South Korea because I thought I should try and become a Zen monk. So that was the first aspect of the calling. Even though I'd had lots of dreams in terms of becoming a Sangoma, I was frightened of it because of everything around it, you know, the cultural milieu in terms of apartheid and me being a white guy. But I realized in South Korea that I had to follow the calling and come home and vote for Mandela and find a teacher if that was the direction I was supposed to go in.
The archetype here shows up all over the place, which is you get that calling. And, you know, in the Bible and all the stories, the first reaction to it isn't generally like, oh, great, I'm going to go do this thing. But usually it's attempting to evade it because it's so weird or it's scary. You know, mm-hmm. we're talking about Jonah and the whale. You know, he didn't want to do what God wanted him. He gets eaten by a whale. Everyone, you know, the general reaction isn't like, oh, awesome, I'm going to go off to become a healer. It's usually like, well, if it was me and I was having those dreams, I would just think like, it's time to cut back on the acid. I wouldn't be able to, even with like confirmation, even when I was seeing the reality of it, you know, and it's, you know, have you ever heard the term default reality?
No, but you can explain it more to me. Thank you.
Yeah, default reality. It's like the name for like just sort of the zeitgeist. I guess is another way for saying zeitgeist, but it's just sort of like the accepted notion of how things work. So now that people don't care that default reality now versus default reality a few hundred years ago might as well be another dimension, like what we accepted hundreds of years ago versus now. It's completely different. But default reality is generally secular, maybe a little superstitious, but we think dreams are just kind of like some like brain flatulence. You know, you wake up, whoa, that was a weird one. Then you forget about it. You know, we aren't really quite sure what happens when you die. We certainly don't believe in any kind of paranormal anything, though. Maybe there's something like once that thing happened to me. And when synchronicities happen, they're generally forgotten. Default reality. And so when you're enmeshed in that, and you start getting what in your awesome book you called, oh my goodness, hold on, I'm sorry, my notes. What is it, dreaming sickness? What did you call it? Calling dream. When you started getting the calling dream, yeah. while still in default reality, you go to the wrong place. Let's imagine that you didn't have the resources to even understand what that was. You go to the wrong therapist, you're gonna get a diagnosis. They're not going to be like, oh, you've got the calling dream. You need to go study this. They're going to be like, listen, we're going to get you on probably a light antipsychotic. Maybe you're a little depressed or something like that. And then you're really locked into default reality. So I wonder if you could talk about how you overcame all of those barriers that were keeping you from taking that first trip to meet your teacher.
I started Zen meditation a number of years before, and I found meditation really, really helpful. And because what meditation does, and it was Zen meditation, but all meditation, it gets you to basically see beyond Maya, Maya's illusion. And I had a lot of compassion, and still do, for a lot of my family and friends who maybe didn't understand my calling. Because how could they? It was not something that we were educated about. So it's very easy to judge, but I didn't feel that was my place because of the way I was brought up as well. So what the meditation did was very deep meditation, working with koans and riddles. I was meditating in the snow of South Korea, and it was very cold, and I did a 3-month silent retreat there. And I managed to break through some of these illusions or obstacles that I had in my own mind and find compassion for people and for my community. And that all I could do was be true to my own spirit and what was being called inside of me. And I had to connect with a warrior, with a warrior energy inside of me. And what gave me courage was my Zen masters in South Korea, because they spoke about war. I mean, they spoke about basically apartheid, which in English means separation. And the biggest apartheid we all suffer is between our minds and our hearts. And everyone has that inside of us. And we see that in the modern world right now. It hasn't changed. So the grandmaster, which was Sung San, or we call Daesun Sunim, who was actually the original teacher of Trudy Goodman, who is a mutual friend of ours.
Wow.
And Daesun Sunim went to San Francisco, and that's where he met Trudy and other members of the Sangha there in California. But when I was in South Korea, Daesun Sunim, or Sung San, the Grand Master would speak about civil war. He spoke about the war between North and South Korea and how the suffering that he experienced is what propelled him to meditation and propelled him to going on a silent retreat himself in South Korea and getting this incredible enlightenment. So his suffering of not being able to go back to North Korea, of experiencing the war, he turned that suffering into the energy behind his meditation. Mm. So he inspired me because that's what I did. I felt my suffering of being a medic in the South African army and experiencing all the woundedness from the soldiers and all the suffering from the Angolan war. I turned all that suffering and made it energy for my meditation, just the way he did as a previous soldier. And so when I meditated like a soldier. And then I looked around the room and there was a lot of guys who used to be soldiers in the Eastern Bloc. So Russia, Eastern Europe, Poland. When the war stopped in all these places, these guys were so hungry for spirit and for soul that some of them found themselves in this same temple like me. And some of them are still monks to this day.
Wow. That's so interesting. Especially like with Zen, as opposed to say Tibetan Buddhism, which is like, you know, apparently is originates from Bon, which was a shamans in the Tibetan plateau. Zen, it doesn't have, as far as I'm aware, a lot of the kind of mystical component that you find in these other, now I could be completely wrong about this. I didn't study it as long as I've been looking into Tibetan Buddhism. So smack it down if I'm wrong about this, but I'm just curious how in the midst of having like these very powerful, bizarre experiences, you were drawn to this like very austere, very simple, form of Buddhism?
Well, firstly, Duncan, there is a lot of mysticism in the Zen tradition, but it's not spoken about that much. But when you do go into it and you get to meet the teachers, it's a private discussion around what we call koans, riddles. So if you think of the dreams as riddles in terms of opening the soul and the spirit to more enlightenment, then you will find that in the Zen tradition, but it's not something that is kind of advertised really. But in my case, I think when I first found Zen, I can tell you the exact moment that I found Zen, the exact moment. I was 18 years old. I was holding the hand of one of my patients who was dying. And they just turned the machines off. He had had a car accident and he'd had very, very serious brain injury. I'd been nursing him for 6 weeks. And every day his mother said to me, is he going to live or is he going to die, John? I was 18 years old. All I said was, he's going to live. But in my heart, I knew that he didn't have much long to go.
Right.
And one day a decision was made to turn off the life support keeping him alive. And it was such a painful story in that particular ward. And it was such a difficult experience for a lot of the nursing staff that the older medics or medical orderlies, as we are called, found it so difficult that they asked me if I could do the vital observations for his last breath or his last breathing. And I felt that I had a responsibility to be close by his side. So I was feeling the pulse all around his body fading and I felt him dying. And then the last moment of my shift, where I was just about to leave, and I knew that once I'd left and I was going to go and leave for like 2 days, but when I was going to come back a few days later, I think it might have even been the next day, I'm not sure, but I didn't feel that he was going to be there. I felt that he was going to be gone, so I was going to miss his passing. So I made a prayer to the universe and I said, this suffering right here, right now, is wrong. And I said, I want you to teach me a way of helping people so that if I'm ever in this extreme form of suffering again, that I can do something effectual, something to bring more peace and more healing, because this situation is just so painful and it's just wrong, you know. So then I made that prayer, and it was very, very, very strong. It was very strong, like I say. And then I left, and the next day when I came in, or a few days later, his room was empty. He had passed. And then something very mysterious happened to me. Within 2 weeks, a friend of mine came to me and he said to me, John, I'm starting the Zen Buddhist classes on how to meditate. And I said, what's Zen and what's Buddhism and what is this meditation? This was like mid-90s. And he said, no, Zen speaks about suffering and how to end suffering. And I said, right, I'm in. And I said, when are you going? And he told me, and I went. And then it just so happened that he was also learning French, and this lady was a French teacher, and she was also a lay nun under the late Zen master Deshimaru from Japan. So she taught us in a very old form of Soto Zen, and I took to the Zen and the discipline and the chanting like a soldier, you know. And in my first retreat, after my first retreat, is when I had this incredible dream where I was called to become a Sangoma, which started this whole journey for over 30 years. Okay.
It's like the Zen was a sort of precursor.
Yes.
It opened you up enough so that you could even be aware that you were having dreams like that. You needed it. This is my suspicion with the Neem Karoli Baba and the Ram Dass people, and why there's this element of mindfulness is, you know, and the constant tension between the Buddhists and the Bhaktis is, you know, the two go very well together in some ways. Like, one opens you up so that you can maybe experience some of these possibilities that people like you have experienced. I don't want to spend too much time on more on the Zen thing, but only because I've been wondering about it. I do understand what the koans are, and I understand that they're confusing. I've certainly been confused by the ones I've looked at, but the most confusing part of it, and maybe this is because I don't have it right, is that apparently after some period of meditation, the Zen master will ask you one of these strange riddles and you will respond with the correct answer, but you've never heard the riddle before, or you don't know the answer. It just somehow pops out of you or something. And I'm just curious, did you have that experience? And what is the explanation for that? Like, how does that even work?
I had that experience, yes. I could say I did have that experience. But it was a particular riddle that I've been working on for some time in South Africa. And our teacher was an amazing man, actually, and he was an old friend of Trudy's, and he was Subong, Zen Master Subong, actually from Hawaii. And he was our personal Zen master who came to South Africa, and he was going to be trained to take over from Daesun Sinim, but it never happened because he died. He died quite soon after my retreat in 1993 with him. So that was really very hard for us in South Africa. And it was interesting for us because Subong was American. You know, he was half Chinese, Korean, brought up in Hawaii, educated in California. But he was a very strict Zen master, like in the olden days. And since I've been to California now, and I was like, wow, it's amazing that he came from this strict place. I mean, this laid back, easygoing, kind of let's get high kind of place, you know?
Was he whacking you with sticks? Did he do the whack?
We did get that, but only if you ask for it. So you basically bar, and then he wouldn't do it. It would be the head monk. So it would be like the head monk in the room would do the stick, and you ask for it. So you put your hands together and you bow, and then you wait, and then they do it. And they do it in a very, very respectful way. And it's very helpful, actually, with all the sitting and meditation.
Oh, I get it. If you've done any amount of meditation, like if you haven't really meditated, you hear about that, you're like, well, that's BDSM. What is that? But if you've done any kind of meditation where you're nodding off and you need to wake up, I could see how that would like energetically definitely like get you back in the moment. I see the usefulness of it. I get it. Someone needs to invent like an automated one for people who don't have Zen masters, you know, press a button, it whacks you. Now, okay, again, so you, I'm so sorry, because I know this is where the answer to this question is probably go do a retreat for a long time and you will know why you can answer these koans in that way. But only because I think that you clearly have a vast understanding of the spirit world or the whatever you want to call that place. And that's what I want to get into, is I want to talk to you about the cosmology of that place from your lineage. But I'm just curious about this particular possibility. Like, I buy telepathy. I buy pretty much anything. And I've certainly been around people, as you have, we've experienced things. We're like, oh, okay. They're not like tricking us. But this thing where your mind produces the correct answer for what seems to be a non-logical question, I just wonder where did that answer come from? And how did it feel when it came out of your mouth? Did it feel like you had solved a puzzle, or was it spontaneous?
That's a very good question. All I could say, there's one word for it, and that's clarity. There's a moment of clarity. Mm. And think about it like this, Duncan, like you're watching a movie, or let's say a play. You're watching a play, a Shakespearean play, and then you've got the curtains. And you're watching the play, and it's amazing. And then the play is over, and the curtains close, and then they open again, and you get to see the background of how they're organizing the play. And these people the props come off, or the masks come off. And for a moment, you get to see everything that's happening there. And then the director will be like, oh, and you've got to close the curtains. We can't let the public see this. So it's a bit like that moment of clarity, just 1 second or even a millisecond, you get to see the truth of something. You get to see through the veil, and that's a veil of illusion. And I want to speak, Duncan, not just about koans or riddles. I want to speak about life, this present moment, and dreams. So three things. The riddle we're speaking about, which is confusing in terms of Zen, and also the dreams we have at night, and then also this moment where people might choose to take, you know, like yourself, a psilocybin, hallucinogens, or whatever it is. So what we are all looking for is that moment where the veil comes down and we get to see the truth. And the truth can be scary, can be painful, can be ugly. But when we get to see the truth, there's some kind of beauty in that that is indescribable. Mm-hmm. And if you want to talk in terms of Buddhist language or even shamanic language, we could say that this moment, even with you and me right now, and with the listeners hearing us later, this is a dream. And our job as people looking to become more conscious is to wake up from this dream. So what does it mean for you and I right now to wake up from this dream, to be 100% conscious of this moment that we're in? And that's why you and I and many others love Ram Dass, because Ram Dass would always speak about be here now, be here now. So this moment is a dream. And yeah, in the Zen tradition, we would say that when you're starting the Zen training, you know, cutting wood, doing the laundry, doing all the basic mundane things is normal. And then over time, cutting wood, doing the laundry, that changes. It's no longer the same. And then you have this epiphany, and then you're back down to doing the laundry, cutting wood, and doing all the domestic chores. But something changes. And yes, what changes is that we wake up from this dream state that we're in. Now, I've been working a lot in the Kalahari. I do a lot of dreams and tracking retreats. Dreams and tracking retreats in the Kalahari. That's what I'm doing right now. And one of the reasons why I'm doing it is because I want to work with ancient man. So ancient man and modern man, and help us all to sit around a fire and revision our future together. So the ancient man are the Bushman people of the Khoisan, and the Khoisan or the Bushman people of Southern Africa are seen as one of the oldest indigenous tribes or people in the world. And a lot of modern archaeological studies maintain that the birthplace of mankind is actually the Kalahari Desert in Botswana in southern Africa, because that's the oldest remains we have found in terms of our human lineage. And the reason why I'm mentioning this to you is because as Sangomas in southern Africa, we get a lot of our ancient cosmology and spiritual teachings from the Khoisan, from the Bushman people. And this links into the teaching we're sharing right now about dreams and Zen. And all I could say is there's a very old saying amongst the Khoisan, amongst the Bushman people, where they say that this world that we are living in right now is a dream being dreamt by Gamata, the great dreamer. And all the spiritual practices we do of dancing, singing, chanting, working with plant medicine, meditation, it's all about having this moment of clarity where we see beyond the veils. We see where the curtains of the theater stay open and we get to see the director. We get to see the dreamer of dreamers, the dancer of dancers. We get to see the great spirit in action. And then in that moment is when we get clarity in terms of our calling and we get clarity in terms of our life. So that's one of the reasons why I've created these retreats, so that people can have just a moment of clarity where that portal takes them to that connection with Gamata, to the great dreamer. So all we need is a moment, and in that moment it's like a portal where we slide into another space in our minds and we connect to something which is ancient. So that's why I created these retreats.
I want to thank ZipRecruiter for supporting this episode of the DTFH. Did you know there are currently over 2.4 million podcasts in the world, including the renowned one that you're listening to right now? And it takes a team of people for me to make this work. I need Nicole. She does all of my bookings. I need Aaron. He does all the editing. I need Francois Nenzoix, who does all the scripts, who writes everything that my guests say and that I say. And of course, I need Blamford Damford, my happiness clown, who comes out when I'm feeling low and cheers me up. This is just a few. There's over 376 people who work for the DTFH at this point, and I couldn't have found them without ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter, it's where you want to go if you're hiring for a podcast or for your growing business or anything. And right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/Duncan. ZipRecruiter uses its powerful technology to find and match the right candidates up with your job. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. So if you're a fan of this podcast and you want to try ZipRecruiter for free today, you need to remember our special URL, ZipRecruiter.com/Duncan. Once again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/Duncan. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Thank you, ZipRecruiter. Now, back to John Lockley.
Where do they say they came from? Like we say, well, it's the oldest indigenous people on the planet. How did they get here? Is it just they were dreamed into existence, or what is the story? What's their origination story?
Oh, that's a good question. I'd have to ask one of them. It's all different theories. Some people say they come from the stars, and some people, they say different things. So I'll let you know when I come back.
Yeah, let me know. I'd love to hear. I mean, I've heard this, that they came from the stars, which is, by the way, that's not just, they're not the only indigenous people that say that. There's many others who say, with some of them with real precision about what star systems they came from. I find it to be really interesting. But I want to talk a little bit about the veil and this, what you're saying is behind it, the director, the great dreamer. What are your theories on what this place is? Is it simultaneous to the experience that we're having right now? In other words, like as we're having this experience, there's some background going on, an extra dimensional reality that is happening. Is it imaginary? You know, is it just metaphor? And finally, if this thing is so real, do you think at some point there might be a way to quantify it other than anecdotal evidence? Do you think that this place could potentially actually be charted by humanity in a way that makes it more accessible to like materialists?
That's a big question, Duncan.
It's a big one.
Wow, that's a big question for me, eh?
Yes.
Okay, well, all I could say, and I hope I'm just going to try and simplify it for myself, and I can just say some things that I've been working on, and that is that, you know, we are all multi-dimensional creatures. As human beings, we are multi-dimensional. And you, with your podcasts and your teachings, let's put it that way, your dharma, or the way you share yourself with the world, I mean, you are in a classic case of someone who's a multi-dimensional being. I mean, you are, Duncan, you know, and then meeting you in Ram Dass's retreat, there was a number of people there who were awake to their multidimensionality. And Ram Dass was, I mean, he's our master. He was there. It was clear.
Yes.
But I want to speak about this. What does it take to embrace your multidimensionality? And in the Xhosa system, amongst the people of Nelson Mandela, Desmond Tutu, the Xhosa tribe, and other people of Southern Africa, we speak about Ubuntu. Ubuntu means humanity, and it's an intricate Southern African philosophy and also spiritual way. It's not a religion, it's a way of being. And what they say, Umtu, Gumtu, Ngabantu, which means a person becomes a person through other people. So through our relationships with one another, through our relationships with our ancestors, and through our relationships with the plants and animal worlds and the unseen worlds, we connect with our Ubuntu, our humanity. And now the clincher of it here, they say, is that people are born as human beings, but they have to make a decision to become a human being.
Ah, that's cool.
That's the clincher to opening the door to your multidimensionality. You made that decision, it's clear. I mean, when I first met you, it's obvious. I mean, you know, the work you're doing, you made the decision. Because
I think so.
You're embracing your multidimensionality. The only way to do that is to say yes to being a human being with all its pain and all its confusion.
Right. Yeah, and this saying yes, I mean, you don't do it just once, right? I mean, you probably have to say yes more than once. It's a continual, like, fine, I'll be human today, I guess. But I'd rather be a bug someday.
Stories of Nelson Mandela, he gave a classic story where he was incarcerated by these white people who treated him terribly. And he said he was filled with righteous anger. I mean, who wouldn't be? He's now in prison for the rest of his life just because he wants to save his people from incarceration and a life of slavery. I mean, my God. So he feels all this anger, and you read about it in his book, his autobiography. And I just want to share this because this is a classic case of connecting with your humanity and your multidimensionality. Okay, so there he is. He's in his little cell. He's filled with anger, like he just hates white people. He hates what's happened to him. And all of us will go, yeah, I don't blame the guy. And in the midst of his hatred, there was this little voice in his head that said to him, Nelson, Nelson, this hatred's going to kill you.
Wow.
You need to learn to befriend the enemy. You need to learn to befriend the enemy. And he just heard this voice as he went to sleep. And then the next morning he wakes up, he's back in this prison, he's not free, but he's connected to that multidimensionality of freedom that we've been speaking about. But now he's in this physical prison. So he hears that voice, and the jailer opens the door and says, good morning, Mr. Mandela, or I think his number, 66, whatever his number was. And then he turned to the guy as a white jailer, young guy, and he says, with a certain amount of vehemence naturally, what made you decide to become a jailer? And he said, actually, I had no choice. He says, what do you mean? Because in his mind, you know, the programming that we all have in our stories, all white people have a choice is what, you know, it's in his mind here, yeah. You know? And he said, you know, my dad died when I was very young. And he said, I've got six brothers and sisters and I'm the oldest and I had to go and get a job and support my family. And he said, he was only 14 at the time, the jailer. And the only job that they would take him at the time was the jailers. And then they carried on talking like this. And Nelson Mandela said that he was shocked in that moment because in his mind, the story was that all white people were privileged. And he realized in that moment that he had had more privilege than this young jailer, because when his dad died when he was seven, he was brought into the prince of the royal family of the Xhosa nation, and they looked after him and educated him. So that's how he got a degree. So they carried on talking like this, and then the next thing the jailer, Nelson says, what part of South Africa are you from? And he said, no, the Eastern Cape. He said, I'm from the Eastern Cape. And then he said, Oya sazi ukuthetha isiXhosa? He says, ewe mfundi, ndiyathetha, ndiyathetha kakhulu. He says, do you speak the language of isiXhosa? And he said, yes, I do. Then the next thing, the two of them were speaking in Nelson Mandela's mother language.
Wow.
And
wild.
And when finally Nelson Mandela became the president of South Africa, on his right was this jailer, this young guy.
What?
And they'd become best friends, yeah.
What?
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yes.
That is incredible.
Yeah, that's the truth. They became very close friends because Nelson Mandela realized that this young guy was a victim of circumstance, that he had no choice but to become a jailer. And you know what Nelson did when he was incarcerated all those years? He encouraged this young guy to get an education, to finish his schooling.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah,
that's
amazing.
So cool. That so define from this perspective. Like the story helps me understand it, but if you had to define it from this perspective, what does it mean to be human? Like, what are their characteristics? Like, how do you know if you've actually become a human or you just think you've become a human?
It's a very good question, Duncan. And I think the answer is also very simple. And that is, to be a human is to be a creature. The default of a human being is a creature that is empathic, loving, compassionate, and also a custodian of the planet, someone who waters their plants, that looks after the animals, that is not a voracious consumer, that cares for the natural plants and animal life around them, and also honors their ancestors, honors those who have walked before them.
Now, you talk a lot about being a warrior. How does that square with war? Like, how does a warrior... Tell me about that. I mean, this in the I love Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, and I've read much about what he said about that. But yeah. Maybe some people haven't heard that. You know, when we think of war, we think of atrocity. I mean, you've seen it. We think of, in fact, the opposite of humanity, like reducing the enemy to something that you don't feel rotten about killing if you can. So, tell me about this, your version of warrior, as opposed to what might be the common understanding of like someone at war, like a warrior, violence, aggression, control, dominance.
I think to be a warrior means to look within, because the first war that starts is the war inside yourself. Because someone who's at peace with themselves does not make someone else wrong, does not belittle someone else, does not intimidate, undermine, and hate and hurt someone else or even another right. animal. Because sometimes someone who's filled with war inside of them, what do? They kick the dog and they torture animals. So
yes.
Someone who has made peace with themselves is someone that... has actually had to be a warrior, because the first war is the war inside ourselves, is the war of separation, of apartheid between our head and our hearts.
Right.
And that ties in with what we are talking about with the veil of consciousness, where we are locked into our stories and our ignorance. Just like Mandela was locked into this idea of all white people being privileged and having this hatred towards them, he learned in that moment of truth where the veil came down and that voice inside of him said, this hatred is going to kill you. So that you need to befriend the enemy. So he, in that moment, was being called to become a warrior, to actually look inside himself and be humble and see what is the truth and what is the lie inside himself in terms of white people. And that gave him the skill to actually be one of the world's greatest politicians and greatest leaders.
Wow. I mean, it's just such a mess in there, though. You know, I totally get it. It's like, oh, this whole heart-head thing that Ram Dass taught us, that you hear about, it's just, you know, I think a lot of people, when they even come close to the heart, as Ram Dass, as you call it, as many people call it, they associate that with just profound vulnerability. They associate it with, weakness. Like, how am I to successfully defend myself from perceived threats if simultaneously I'm opened up and I'm loving and I'm joyful and I'm, you know, seeing everybody as, that's not a prison guard. That's somebody who got sucked into some rotten karma. That's not somebody, that person who hurt me the most in my life. They must be suffering so much. The moment you start going down that path, I think many people feel like, great. That might be great for you, a healer. And that might be great for me, a podcaster. But I live in, you know, someone's like, I live in fucking New York, man. You want me to go around with an open heart? Come on. I got to be tough. I got to get in the cab. You know, I got to push and push my way through. So can you talk a little bit about that? The when you hear things like this, generally the assumption is, therefore, you're going to turn into some kind of like, you know, thing on the ocean floor that crawled out of its shell for a few blissful moments. Only to get chomped by a shark.
Oh, that's beautiful. I love that. I think, yeah, it's a very good question, because this is a common question in spiritual circles. And being loving and open-hearted does not mean that you're a pushover. Being compassionate does not mean that people do whatever they like to you. I think to be open-hearted and compassionate is to actually first feel your own spirit, your own soul, your own connection to the great dreamer. That's where we have to make peace with ourselves first. So that's where the warrior energy comes in. You first have to show a lot of compassion for yourself and your own foibles and your own, like, the saboteur and the inner critic and all this. You know, we often are our worst enemies are ourselves. So we have to really get to know ourselves and actually be compassionate with ourselves. And I remember my old Zen master, Su Bong. This one lady asked him a question once about Buddhism. And she said, she's a lovely librarian in our local Sangha. And she said, so Mr. Zen Master, Buddhism is about compassion. It's all about compassion. And and he just shouted at her and he put his Zen stick in the ground and he said, too much compassion turns to shit, he says, you know. Like, I mean, that might have been a bit too strong. You know, later years, I've thought about that. It was quite a strong answer. But I think the point he's making is that sometimes the compassionate action also means to say you are wrong, you know. Like, yes. In the situation, Su Bong was very good about the situation in South Africa, and he spoke to us and he said some kind of demonstration is needed. And a demonstration of love is also going into the township where people might hate you because you've got white skin, and actually say, what can I do to help? Or like making a demonstration. Or a demonstration of going in front of the police and say, you know, this is wrong, but I'm just going to stand and hold my space and demonstrate. That's scary, you know, and I'm not calling for people to do that. But what I am calling for people to do is to feel your edge. Becoming a human being means feeling your edge. And as you feel your edge, you feel the warrior. As you feel the warrior, you feel that multidimensional magic that connects us to our humanity. So a better question is, what does it take for you to find your edge? Some people find their edge through illness. Some people find their edge through adversity, through difficulty, through, often it's through difficulty where you find your edge. Like I found my edge through experiencing illness, in particular the Twaza illness, and being sick for, you know, 7 to 10 years. It's the only time I felt some kind of peace inside of me actually was when I accepted the illness. I accepted the fact that I wasn't well, that I was struggling, and I meditated. So when I sat on my cushion, I had to, each time I sat, each day, I had to basically befriend the illness and go, okay, I'm sick, let go, let go. Don't fight it. Don't fight the illness, let go. And then when I did that, then I got these profound dreams. But I had to find my edge in terms of experiencing this illness, having no energy, going to one doctor after the next who didn't give me any help. We just said, there's nothing wrong with you, or we can't pick up anything. And then feeling disgruntled and going back home again, sitting on my cushion, and then just having to let go and just let go into the illness and befriend it.
So it's like the edge is the thing that happens after you hit bottom. It's not hitting bottom. It's the moment where you hit bottom and realize that, you know, that you're not going to die. That even though everything is on paper a disaster, you find something that seems to be, I don't know what the word for it is, outside of phenomena or something, like some kind of non-conditioned peace or something.
That's right. It's a bit like when you're having a dream and you dream that you're flying and then you're going to crash land, and then suddenly you wake up and you go, oh, thank God, you know, it's just a dream, you know?
Yeah. And is that the same thing as enlightenment?
I don't know. You'll have to find it and then tell me.
50 incarnations. We'll do another podcast. That's being very generous with me. So last question. Where do you do your retreats, and what can someone expect when they come to one of these retreats? Are there psychedelics involved? Is this like an ayahuasca ceremony? What's going on at these things?
So the retreat is, I'm actually going to be doing like a wilderness retreat in Colorado, actually in end of October. But in terms of my dreams and tracking retreats, they in Botswana, and people fly into the Okavango, they fly into Maun. And it's a 7 days in a lodge in the Kalahari. And then it's 3 days in the Okavango Delta in tents. It's like glamping. But the 7 days, the focus of the 7 days is actually to help people connect with that space inside of them that we're speaking about, to create a portal of connection with the great dreamer. And we're going to be walking every day, walking through the bush, tracking the wild animals like cheetah, rhino, lion, just tracking the animals on foot for 2 hours in the morning before breakfast. And then I create the shrine tent in the bush where I teach people basically how to pray in an ancient way in terms of connecting with their ancestors, connecting with their spirit, and to find their edge like we're speaking about. It's very beautiful. We don't push people. It's very laid back. It's very relaxing.
John, if somebody wants to skip hunting, tracking, I'm sorry, deadly animals, can we just go to the prayer tent, like sleep
no,
in?
No, we don't hunt animals.
I know you don't hunt. I'm sorry, I didn't mean hunt, but you know, I don't know if I want to track a lion. I might just want to go to the prayer tent. I don't want to find a lion. In fact, I think most people spend a lot of their time avoiding these animals.
Well, there's not really that many lions in that area, to be honest, and it's very, very safe. Otherwise, we wouldn't do it. We walk about 7 or 8 people. We walk in a line, and it's very safe. And the fact that we're walking in the spaces where there are wild animals and potentially dangerous animals is all about finding your edge, you know.
Wow.
In order to preserve the wilderness, we have to respect the wilderness. In order to respect the wilderness, we have to learn to understand the wilderness. And part of this understanding is learning from master trackers. And one of the master trackers is my partner, my business partner, Arwen, who's running the tracking side of the company, and also some of the Khoisan or Bushman trackers. And they are teaching us how to follow the signs of the wilderness so that we can actually be better human beings, you know?
Yeah. Wow, that sounds really, really fun.
I'd love you to join us, actually, Duncan. I think you'd be amazing there, you know?
It's going to be a long conversation with my wife. A long, long. You're not tracking animals. I want another baby. You're not going to find a leopard. We're having more kids. I'll talk to her about it, though. My friend just went out there and was describing the beauty of that place to me, and it made me fantasize about seeing it one day. That sounds incredible.
You know, I can just leave this with a thought for people. One of the things was I found absolutely incredible was to hear the sound of the lions roaring. And it was like this palpable, actually, vibration. It was like a chant. It was like this incredible chant done by like Krishna Das or someone, but on another level. And that vibration of the lions roaring, actually, it kind of affected my system, you know, because it's a physical, palpable experience when you hear a lion roaring. And it helps us to wake up because it connects to that ancient memory inside of us, you know.
John Lockley, thank you so much for this conversation. So enlightening. Maybe we'll end up in Botswana together. That would be a peak experience for me. Can you tell folks where they can find you?
Yes, I have my book. You say my book, Leopard Warrior, but I have my website, johnlockley.com. And then they can find out about the dreams and tracking retreats. And also my book, Leopard Warrior and audio teaching, The Way of the Leopard, which are both produced by Sounds True. And it was a wonderful experience doing those two things, the book and the audio teachings.
All the links you need to find John will be at DuncanTrussell.com. Thank you so much. I really, really appreciate your time. Thank you, John.
Thanks, Duncan. Thank you.
Hare Krishna. That was John Lockley, everybody. You can find more about him by going to johnlockley.com. A tremendous thank you to our sponsors. All those offer codes are going to be at DuncanTrussell.com. And do subscribe to my Patreon, won't you? It's patreon.com/DTFH. And finally, come see me. I'm going to be performing in Fort Worth and Dallas. It's coming right up. That's November 11th and November 12th. I hope to see you there. Until then, Hare Krishna.